All right. Welcome to this program of the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am a program coordinator here at the American Writers Museum. I'm here to introduce to you our guests for our next event today. Last year, at the height of the pandemic, the American Writers Museum launched a new podcast series called Dead Writer Drama, which looks at the untold stories behind the real, messy lives of America's greatest writers. From Hemingway and Fitzgerald's legendary bromance to the many loves of Zora Neale Hurston, hosts and best-selling authors Jennifer Cation Armstrong and Zakiya Dalia Harris talk with the experts about everything you didn't learn in high school English class. We're thrilled to be able to present this live recording of the podcast to kick off the 2022 season of Dead Writer Drama. Please join me in welcoming Jennifer and Zakiya.
Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends, brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Dalia Harris, author of The Other Black Girl.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written seven books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television.
January 12, 1965. Lorraine Hansberry, 34, dies, author of A Raisin in the Sun. Lorraine Hansberry, one of the most promising young American playwrights, died of cancer yesterday at University Hospital. She was 34 years old. Miss Hansberry, author of A Raisin in the Sun and the current The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, had been in and out of the hospital over the last 2 years. She was unable to help fashion the last play as it took shape in rehearsals. She left the hospital occasionally to watch its progress and to attend its opening on October 15th at the Long Acre Theater. She returned to the hospital 2 days later, however, and remained there until her death. The play drew mixed notices from the critics, but many theatrical people, clergy, and others who were impressed with the work rallied to its support. They formed a committee, raised money, and have kept the production going on a week-to-week basis. Last night's performance of the play, which is now at Henry Miller's Theater, was canceled. The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window was Miss Hansberry's second venture into big-time theater. On March 11th, 1959, the slim, cheery, talkative young woman with a gay, flashing smile took on the Broadway stage with A Raisin in the Sun and won an unexpected victory. For the 28-year-old Miss Hansberry, who had never had a play produced, the premiere at the Ethel Barrymore was more than a personal triumph. The work was described not as a Negro play, but one about people who happened to be Negroes. And its author, too, insisted throughout her short lifetime that she was not a Negro playwright, but a writer who happened to be a Negro. Miss Hansberry's works and her often eloquent statements attested to the energy with which she resisted stereotypes on the stage and in her workday life. Hansberry's literary involvement was illustrated by the wide range of projects, some of them near completion, that occupied her at her death. There was a musical adaptation of Oliver Lafarge's novel, Laughing Boy, and a study of Toussaint Louverture, the despotic liberator of Haiti. And there was also a drama entitled Les Blancs, which was to deal with the contrasting and conflicting reactions of Negroes and whites living in an African land emerging from colonization.
Miss Hansberry began by writing plays that were read solely by her husband and intimate friends. She wrote three that she never finished, and some short stories, and then came A Raisin in the Sun. I wrote it between my 26th and 27th birthdays, she said. One night after seeing a play I won't mention, I suddenly became disgusted with a whole body of material about Negroes. Cardboard characters, cute dialect bits, or hip-swinging musicals from exotic scores. Her play, dealing with the aspirations, dreams, and frustrations of the younger family, was likened by one critic to Chekhov's Cherry Orchard, in that the knowledge of how character is controlled by environment and the alternation of humor and pathos is similar. The play, which was later adapted for a motion picture, won for Miss Hansberry the New York Drama Critics Circle Award as the best American play of the 1959 season. A Raisin in the Sun ran for 19 months in New York and changed some opinions that had previously considered all plays about Negroes as box office poison. "The thing I tried to show," she said, "was the many gradations on even one Negro family, the clash of the old and the new, but most of all, the unbelievable courage of the Negro people." Lorraine Vivian Hansberry was born in Chicago on May 19, 1930. She attended what she called Jim Crow schools on the South Side, which meant half-day schools. When she was eight, her father bought a house in a white neighborhood. She was first drawn to the theater while at Chicago's Englewood High School, but it was painting she studied at Chicago's Art Institute, the University of Wisconsin, and in Guadalajara, Mexico. In 1950, she moved to New York, where for a while she studied at the New School for Social Research. She worked intermittently as a department store clerk and a producer's helper. She also was a waitress in a Greenwich Village restaurant operated by the family of Robert Nemiroff, a music publisher, to whom she was married in 1953. Miss Hansberry divided her time between an apartment on Bleecker Street above a laundry and a home in Croton, New York, where she enjoyed walking in the woods.
Welcome. So today we'll be discussing the luminous playwright, author, and writer and activist, Lorraine Hansberry. Our guest is Soeika Diggs Colbert, author of Radical Vision, a biography of Lorraine Hansberry. In Radical Vision, Soeika Diggs Colbert narrates a life at the intersection of art and politics, arguing that for Hansberry, the theater operated as a rehearsal room for her political and intellectual work. Celebrated for her play, A Raisin in the Sun, Hansberry was also the author of innovative journalism as well as plays that touched on slavery, interracial communities, and Black freedom movements. Hansberry was deeply involved in the Black freedom struggle during the Cold War and in the early civil rights movement. And here, Colbert shows us an artist's life with the background of the Greenwich Village art scene in the 1960s, the homophile movement, Black diasporic freedom movements, and third wave feminism.
Drawing from Hansberry's papers, speeches, and interviews, this book, called Brilliant by Imani Perry in the New York Review of Books, and a devoted and deeply felt account of the development of an artist's mind by Dave Itzkoff in the New York Times Book Review, provides a new point of entry in the history of Black radicalism and a new perspective on Black women in mid-20th century political movements. Now, to the author of this brilliant biography, Soeika Diggs Colbert. Colbert is the Idle Family Professor of African American Studies and Performing Arts at Georgetown University. Colbert's writing has appeared in the Washington Post, Public Books, Metrograph, and American Theater. She has been interviewed on NPR and commented for the New York Times, USA Today, CNN, and the Washington Post. And she is Associate Director at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, DC. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to talk a little bit first about our own experiences of Lorraine Hansberry. We always sort of start off by talking about how we learned about these people in school, which is almost always very different from what we end up, you know, learning about their real lives here. So what was your experience, Zakiya?
Yeah, so I first read A Raisin in the Sun my freshman year of high school. This would be 2006. I don't know why I felt the year is important, but I do think in terms of time and what people are talking about. So for Hansberry, that was the only work that I read, and I remember loving it because as a young Black girl, seeing that another Black woman had written this play and we were taking it seriously and studying it, like I don't remember reading many Black female author, like writers in elementary school, now that I think about it, like in the school system. So that was my first time. I also remember having to memorize the poem, Dream Deferred. Totally. I do not remember it anymore. I wish I could recite it today. But yeah, very fond memory.
Yeah, yeah. I went to school in the southwest suburbs of Chicago and a very white area. And I feel like this was the only experience that I would have had of maybe, I mean, I don't want to say of all Black writers, but mm-hmm. like, it's one of the few, and it really stood out for me, especially because it was a play, too. It was like, yeah, that's exciting, right? It was like, and it was so accessible. And I remember that, too. And I think of it as almost like the Cosby Show of plays in a way, because it was like, I think all even white kids had to read this play. Mm-hmm. And this was your picture of that. And I do remember also that because it was Chicago and I was familiar with it, that felt like I had a connection with it a little bit. And I barely even knew that many Black kids in my school. And so I just,
same.
Right? It's really crazy. And there wasn't any concern really at the time about like making sure we got diverse, even, you know, reading lists and that sort of thing. But this one was there. Mm-hmm. And that is really telling in a bunch of ways that we'll I'm sure get into more, both that I think it felt accessible to everyone. And it's like, it's about homeownership. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, these people that you just, the characters are so good and warm, and you just, I don't know, there's something about it that makes it so accessible, like I said. But it really stands out for me as one of the few things that I had to read and remember written by a Black person and by a Black woman. And I do remember seeing her picture and thinking she was so glamorous because she's really pretty. I'm gonna show you the cover in a little bit. But and also that she was young, and I kind of got that a little bit. Like at least seeing her, and again, as like a woman, a young woman who wants to write, when you see people like that, you think you start to see yourself there. So what was your experience of her in school?
So I, too, first was introduced to Lorraine Hansberry in high school, ninth grade, American literature, mm-hmm. and, you know, one of the few Black figures that we read that year, and certainly, you know, perhaps the only Black woman. I don't know that for a fact, but I know there are very few women and very few Black folks. And you know what's fascinating, and you're making me think I need to run off and do some research about this, because I've thought and written a lot about why the play gets taken up in 1959 as an iconic play in terms of, you know, it being so successful on Broadway and part of American culture. But I haven't thought as much about why it gets taken up in American curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so even now today, it's one of the most taught plays in American secondary schools in the country in 2022. And so it's had that staying power from its production to the present moment. And so it's interesting to think about how people receive the play in terms of educators and in terms of our American educational system and how that sustained itself over time.
Yeah, oh, so much to unpack. So we're gonna start kind of with an early life question. So in your biography, you describe Lorraine as a movement baby. Mm-hmm. And I do remember learning in high school that A Raisin in the Sun was taken in a way from her own experience, her parents' lawsuit. So can you say a little bit about that historical significance?
Absolutely. So Hansberry's parents were part of the Great Migration. So they moved from the South to the North to Chicago. And they were both college graduates, which was rare for Black people at that time. And they were what we would consider today a power couple. So her father was a lawyer and a real estate agent. They both ran for public office, her mother and her father. Her mother was a school teacher. And at one point, Carl Hansberry, her father, who was also a real estate agent, decided he was going to buy a house in a neighborhood that was governed by a racially restrictive covenant. The neighborhood is right on the cusp of where the University of Chicago is now. And so that purchase unfolded into a series of lawsuits that ultimately took him to the Supreme Court, where he hoped to find that racially restricted housing covenants were illegal, and therefore segregated housing in the US was illegal. Now, mind you, while all of this was unfolding and Carl was going back and forth from Chicago to the United States, the Hansberry family was getting harassed on a daily basis outside their home. And so at one point, a neighbor threw a rock through the window, which almost hit young Lorraine. And those incidents in part inspired A Raisin in the Sun. But Hansberry also reflects that while her father was off fighting for justice in Washington, D.C., her mother was defending the home with a gun. And so Carl ultimately won the battle but lost the war. So the Supreme Court found that it was legal for him to buy that house in that neighborhood, but that racially restrictive housing covenants in general were not illegal. And so I think of that moment as Hansberry getting a really fulsome early education civil rights in both the courts as well as in self-defense.
Yeah, and the other thing that I found so fascinating also is that she also believed that what killed her father, right, was suffering. This racism, died of a cerebral hemorrhage at 50 in Mexico, right?
Yeah.
And just to imagine, again, it's these ripple effects, right, of how past generations trauma can really be brought or carried on through generation to generation. And it's really inspiring and not unsurprising, but it makes so much sense that, you know, this play would come from such a place of experience and sadly pain.
It's so Hansberry was also W.E.B. Du Bois's favorite student. He says that. And the reason I bring that up is because both Du Bois and Hansberry's father, Du Bois ended up being an expat. Hansberry's father realized that he couldn't stay in the United States after he lost the court case and continued to not see progress that he wanted to see in civil rights. So he and his wife went to Mexico to look for a home to retire in. And while they were there looking for a home to purchase, he had a cerebral aneurysm and died. And so young Lorraine was left fatherless, and she writes later on that racism helped to kill him.
So I do want to talk about this cover.
Yes.
You can't probably all see it really that well in the back, but you should check it out. You should buy the book is what you should do, so you can see this beautiful image. And since this is a podcast, I'm also just going to describe it briefly. So it's this black and white photo of Lorraine looking pensive, I would say, and she's got her hand up, and she's holding a cigarette that's burning, and she's kind of, it feels very private to me. It feels like this is not the image that we were presented of her looking super glamorous and right at the camera. This is her kind of looking off. And I love the cigarette. The cigarette is key, right? And there's kind of a shadow behind her, and it's black and white, and it's beautiful. Can you talk about why that image for the cover of this?
So I must admit, the image that I picked is a more prototypical Lorraine image. And then my publisher was like, no, that's not the image. So there's a very famous, I'm sure you've seen these photos. There's a very famous set of images that were taken of Hansberry for Vogue. And one of those images actually has Hansberry with a photo of herself on her desk and a superimposed image of her behind her. And so I wanted to use that image because in part the book tries to think about her multiplicity. But I think this image actually does a better job of that because, one, I think the shadow tries to capture that some, but also to your point, we often see the staged, glamorous Lorraine associated with the rays in the sun, and we rarely see her in this light. And there's a whole group of images. Hansberry had friends who are photographers, so there's this whole set of images actually taken of her privately that are really beautiful, and they capture her at home being photographed by a friend, which I think is a different level of intimacy than for, you know, a mainstream magazine.
And that's this one. You can feel it. It almost, it reminds me of, my partner's actually a photographer, so he's taken pictures of me before, and it's like a lot of times he'll catch stuff that almost I think is in between what I think are the images, and that's what this looks like to me. Kind of like she doesn't even really realize her photo's being taken, and I think that's why it's so cool.
Yeah, that's a great segue too, because first of all, I don't think I gushed enough about how good this book is, everyone, but
it's great.
It is fascinating. Right from the beginning, you really set out to tear down kind of preconceived notions, the ways that we've learned about Lorraine Hansberry. And one way you do this, which I found interesting, was that I think
in the introduction, you say you're going to refer to the public Lorraine as Lorraine Hansberry as Hansberry, right? And the private Lorraine, which is very much feels like the one in the cover, as Lorraine. And I'm curious, like, was that something that came up when you first started, or is it something that you were, as you were going along through all of the archives, which is a whole other thing I think we definitely want to talk about, that came to you? And then was there ever a time where you're like, I don't know where?
That's a good question. Yeah. So when I started writing the book, and I think I'd say this in the book, I think of this biography as a story of Hansberry's ideas. And so one of the things that I really was blown away by when I got the chance to look at her papers in the archive is how prolific she was, given how small amount of her work that's been published. And I was even more impressed by her brilliance after reading her papers. And so I really wanted the world to know that she was an intellectual and a radical and this brilliant thinker. And so that was my entry point, and that was the book that I had started to write. And then as I was writing it, I realized that there were all of these things that were happening in her personal life that we needed to know in order to understand her ideas. And so that's where I began to try to parse out the different parts of her. But I do think it's helpful to think about how they're obviously intertwined. And so, you know, one example is her well-known Letters to the Ladder, for example, the lesbian periodical. Is an example of her private self in some ways because she doesn't sign them, but then obviously also part of her, the life of her ideas.
And that was something where eventually, I think, the editor sort of disclosed this. Was it after her death?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we will talk a little bit more, I think, about her love life in a second. But I want to talk about the other part of her that I did not know about at all when we were talking about, you know, learning about her in school, which is, you know, you call this book Radical Vision. And I'm sure that it was deliberately, you know, a departure from what her public image was. It's definitely not what I learned about her in school or what people tended to learn about her in school.
Definitely
not. I was shocked more, you know, most by how radical her vision really was, how very, you know, she had these real visions for freedom for all and that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. I'd rather you talk about that. So what do you think, you know, what was her radical vision and why do you think that was erased from her image?
I don't know, maybe because I didn't have Google at the time. I mean,
oh, I think that was that is really right.
Part of it, right? Because if you read the interviews of her after Raisin Comes Out, so first of all, Hansberry was writing for leftist, Marxist, progressive periodicals, not just one, but several of them, from the time she moved to New York in 1950 to around 56, 57, when she stops writing for periodicals so she can dedicate her time to be writing the play, essentially, in more longer pieces. Thanks to a windfall her husband gets from writing the song Cindy O' Cindy. And so she's writing namely for Paul Robeson's magazine or periodical Freedom. At the time, Paul Robeson's passport has been revoked because right. He's public enemy number one. Hansberry goes to a peace conference in Uruguay, represents Paul Robeson, and then subsequently from then on is followed by the FBI. So the US government knows she's a radical. Anyone who's reading what she's writing about from 50 to 56 knows she's a radical. So the fact that when she's being interviewed by mainstream periodicals after Raisin, and no one asks her about any of this, the closest thing that comes to it is when someone asks her how she feels about the Nation of Islam, and they try to paint her as this wholesome woman against these radical Muslims that are emerging in Harlem. It's always fascinating to me that no one seems to know that she had written all these things that are in the public domain that are under her name. She also wrote under
at that time,
right?
It wasn't like it was that much before.
Years ago, right? She didn't. She did publish things under pseudonyms, but what I'm describing, she wrote. I still have not figured out.
Okay.
I think it's because they didn't have Google.
It's really bizarre to me because she was an actual communist, as they say, a card-carrying communist. But she didn't. I mean, she does have an FBI file, but she didn't get blacklisted.
She didn't. And so by the time she becomes famous, the McCarthy era has waned. Mm. They do send an FBI agent to the Philadelphia production of A Raisin in the Sun. So it goes to New Haven, Philadelphia, and then Broadway. And the agent completely misreads the play and is like, oh, there's nothing here. It's fine. Nothing
to
worry about.
It's the American dream. Yes. It's the American dream.
That's and why so, they love it. You're
yeah.
Right.
And so then, I mean, they continue to follow her, but.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it, I mean, it's, there was a lot, you mentioned this a number of times in the book, that she was so often identified as a housewife, mm-hmm. which is also wild because, like, I guess she probably lived in a house and she was a wife at that time. But it's like, this is a woman who's writing for Paul Robeson and going to Europe and stuff. Like, this is, she's not, that makes it sound like she's at home watching soap operas and ironing, which I maybe she also did and that's fine. But like,
not so much.
I mean, just is it just that that's how people wanted to see her?
I think so. I think people are trying to make sense of her because she was beautiful. That's often all. That's also often
that threw everybody.
On,
I mean, it's right? in the obit. Mm-hmm. Like it's the slim, cheery, like such a
it's
funny
in
detail.
It's the obit, right? That's so. It's so. And the wifiness is a little bit there too.
The wifiness.
Yeah, and she was young. No one knew how to make sense of her.
I guess
it was just very awkward. And the interviews, the recordings of the interviews, you can hear people, the interviewers trying to sort of figure out what to do with her.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So reading this book, we were talking about this before earlier, but this really inspired me to then go try to find some of the interviews. And there was one with Mike Wallace that is, oh, I could not find, I don't think it was recorded actually, like as a video.
Oh, not as a video, there's a sound recording.
Yeah. Oh, there's a sound recording. I would love to hear it because she claps back in such a funny, fascinating way. And throughout this book, I kept kind of keeping track of all the times. So this leads into my next question. So she's been misunderstood and misquoted by so many people, and not just by people, Malcolm X, Harold Cruz, who is the African American Studies professor at Michigan, Mike Wallace, of course, Robert Kennedy also misunderstood her, right? It's such a, so which of these misunderstandings did you find the most significant in terms of like how it maybe affected her legacy, or how it affected the fact that people didn't know certain things about her? Because like you were saying, there was no Google, and a lot of these interactions were maybe not known by the public.
Yeah. Well, I think the most historically significant misunderstandings was the one with her and Robert Kennedy.
Mm.
And so there's a well-known summit that James Baldwin calls to discuss the civil rights issue. And he invites Lorraine Hansberry, Haley Belafonte, Lena Horne, Jerome Smith, who is a civil rights leader at the time, and a whole cadre of black intellectuals. And the attorney general is set on having these black spokespeople convince the students in Birmingham to stop protesting. That's why he's there. The intellectuals are there to convince Robert Kennedy to take a stronger stance, to convince his brother to take a stronger stance on civil rights. So they're already not there with they're at cross purposes from the beginning. So basically, close to the end of the meeting, Hansberry says to Bobby Kennedy that instead of asking all of them what he thinks they should be doing, she should be asking Jerome Smith and the students who are on the ground. And it was always, and this goes back to the question about her being a radical, it was always her way to redirect the attention she was getting as a star to the people on the ground who were doing the work. Mm. And so Bobby Kennedy was completely, he didn't understand what she was saying, what she was asking of him. She told him that it would be a symbolic, that he should ask his brother to escort a child into a school to desegregate it so that people knew when they were spitting on that child, they were spitting on the nation. And he said it would just be, a symbolic gesture. It wouldn't mean anything. And so there was this great impasse because they wanted him to understand the importance of the nation saying, we are invested in desegregation via the presidency. And he was just invested in sort of quieting things down for his brother. And so to me, that was the most historically significant misunderstanding because it could have changed the course of civil rights.
If you think about that image, that would be the image we would see.
Yeah.
But I don't know about the interviews. You know, it's this double-edged sword because even after Hansberry is misunderstood in the 1959 interviews, so the interviews that come out right after Raising the Sun, there are several conversations, public conversations that she has where she's very clear about her politics. And none of that ever gets taught or incorporated or thought about in relationship to the play. And so in some ways, I think that there weren't ears available to hear her at that time. And I'm grateful now that we have the archive, because now I think there's more capacity to see what she was saying.
Yeah. Something I really loved in your book is that you refer a lot to her practices. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of two main ones, right? It's her practice of freedom and her practice of writing. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to refer to both her activism and her writing in this way?
So one of the things that, if there's one thing that I would want folks to take away from the book, is that Hansberry understood freedom as a daily activity rather than a destination. Mm-hmm. And so because she had been mentored by her parents and family members who are part of the Popular Front, who are part of this earlier generation of activism that was really around workers' rights as much as it was around black liberation, she understood how their efforts had set a foundation for the civil rights movement of her generation. And she could see those connections. And so she understood that freedom and advances in terms of civil rights, even when there are moments that seem to leap into the future, there had been days and weeks and years of organizing that led up to those moments. And so that's why I try to refer to it as a practice, because it's something that had to happen continually and perpetually in order to get to the gains that she hoped to see.
I love that. Because then it's also not like you can't really ever declare victory.
Right.
And also you're not looking to. So it helps on both sides, I think, that you have to just keep going.
Yeah.
And that's true of writing too, right? Yeah. We definitely know that as writers, that it's all, you're not just like, okay, I've done the writing. It's over. You're just always working on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of the people who maybe inspired her practice, maybe just to give a sense of like the people she was in community with, and then also the people she was looking to before her, like who are some of those artists and writers?
So she, as I mentioned before, was mentored by Du Bois. Langston Hughes has a lovely letter where she asked him to use the line from his poem Harlem for the title Raising the Sun, but he was a mentor. Alice Childress, whose play just was performed on Broadway and had another staging of her play in Brooklyn, she's finally getting her heyday, was a friend. There's less evidence in the archive that she was a mentor, but they worked together at Freedom and they co-wrote a play. And then in terms of her peers, she had what I can only describe as her relationship with Baldwin. If Sweet Lorraine, which is an essay Baldwin wrote after she died, is any indication, I always tell my students, if you could have a friend that writes about you like that when you die, you have lived a good life. So her relationship with Baldwin is very tender and beautiful. Obviously, she had a big impact on Nina Simone, and their friendship was really important to her. I think I'd be remiss about saying this. I think that Robert Nemroff was the greatest friend of her mind.
Her husband, that's her husband, which we haven't talked a lot about yet.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I want to get to that, so I will, so we can do that now. But your introduction actually beautifully lays out, I think in her own words, but these three major events in her life, all of which happened on a March 10th, right? So it's just to orient people, her father died March 10th of 1945. Raisin in the Sun opened in 1959, and she got a divorce in 1964 from Robert, who she remained friends with, though. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about him and also just any of the other significance of, we obviously know the significance of Raisin in the Sun opening, and we talked a little bit about her father's death, but tell us about her relationship with her husband and the significance of that, and the divorce.
Yeah. So Hansberry and Robert Nemroff had an unconventional marriage and relationship. So it seems that from the very beginning, he knew that she had same-sex desire. And in her letters to the latter, which are published in 1957 and 58, she refers to herself as a lesbian. They met on a picket line. They were both leftist. I think that's what drew them together. He marveled at her intellect and brilliance, and she appreciated his unwavering support and entrepreneurship. And so in many ways, I think that their relationship was more about their collaboration than it was about a sexual relationship or desire in that kind of way. And so they remained intimately close up until the day that she died. He helped to rally to make sure that Sign on Sidney Brustein's window continued on Broadway. He was always her first editor. So you see her writing drafts of things and sending them to him, and him writing back with copious notes, her writing in her journal how annoyed she is with him because he's making her work and she doesn't want to work. He was like a taskmaster. We need the draft, Lorraine.
I love that. Yeah. We all need that.
We do.
Yeah.
Kind of lucky.
Yeah. So they were, yeah, they, I think, and it's telling too that, so they get divorced in 64. They stop living together as husband and wife really in 57. But she leaves her papers to him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think that that's also an indication of how she understood him in relationship to her ideas. On the opening night of Raisin in the Sun, she's sitting next to him, and a woman that she has a crush on is a few seats down.
And he is also a white Jewish man.
Yes.
Right.
So that is, I mean,
double drama.
I think at that time, that alone must have, you know, caused a lot of difficulty for them.
Yeah, so when Hansberry marries Nimroff, she, at the time, there are a lot of interracial couples in the village.
Oh, well, sure.
Yeah, so Mary Baraka is married to a white woman at the time. There's a lot of interracial couples. But the fallout with Malcolm X, which was mentioned before, is there's, Ossie Davis recounts this, these events. But at one point, Hansberry met Malcolm X, and he said to her, he could never trust a woman married to a white man. And so he deems her untrustworthy. But then eventually they make up to the point that Malcolm X is in hiding because he knows that there are people trying to kill him. But he comes out of hiding in the midst of a snowstorm to attend Hansberry's funeral. Mm.
That moment in your book really got me. Like, I was imagining visualizing that, and also like biopic. Like,
if this we were totally talking about how we need a biopic of her. There's so much in there, and she had this short, incredible life, and it's like, you know, it's, and so much that people didn't know about her,
and so much, and so prolific. And I want to make sure that we do give a little time to Not a Raisin in the Sun, because I do feel like a lot of us know this play, and of course you're a professor. I'm just curious, when you're teaching, like, have you happened to teach another Hansberry work? Like, what are the works that you go to and to show your students another side of her?
So I taught a class on Hansberry, Baldwin, and Simone. It was magical.
Wait, can we audit this class?
It was really good. And so in that class, I taught several of her works. I teach the published works, so Raisin, Sign and Sidney Brustein's Window, Le Blanc, The Drinking Gourd, which we should talk about.
Yes.
I teach the recordings of her, which are on Cadman, which have a lot of the interviews, including the a portion of the Mike Wallace interview. I teach her essays. I teach a lot of the published work. And I think that landscape, so Raisin is about Chicago, Sign is about the village in New York. Almost all, there's only one non-white character in the play, which was part of the reason why people were like, wait, what? The black playwright is writing about white people? I don't get it. And then
we still see that today, right?
People didn't like it. And then LeBlanc is about independence movement in a African country, and then The Drinking Gourd is about slavery. So there's a wide range in terms of topics.
And is The Drinking Gourd, is there a production of it we could see anywhere? Is there,
you all should produce it.
Yes.
It is so good.
All right. Mm.
But it has never been produced. Hansberry says it's one of the few times in her life where she was paid very well to write something and for it to not be produced. She said she handed in the script, and an executive put it in a drawer, and they never heard of it again.
Oh my gosh.
It was a made for a TV movie. It was a film script. It wasn't a play.
Okay.
It's not a play.
Okay.
Yeah.
This actually brings me to another question, which is, you know, she worked in actually a bunch of different forms. She wrote poetry, journalism, fiction, And obviously theater is what she was known for. Mm-hmm. And you do talk about the sort of specialness of theater for her in that it's an interaction essentially with an audience. Why do you think theater ended up being the one that she was really known for?
I think that I really think that it was because of the timing and the zeitgeist of A Raisin in the mm-hmm. Sun. Because A Raisin in the Sun premieres on Broadway and amidst the height of kitchen sink American dream dramas on the Great White Way. And many people just see it as, you know, a black version of Arthur Miller, right? And so it's very digestible. You know, at the time you have Eugene O'Neill, Arthur Miller, and Tennessee Williams. And then this sense. Young black woman who's kind of similar, but different. And so I think that that's part of the reason why that play becomes so famous and so well received. And because it's also brilliantly written, the characters, I mean, the lines, it's so good. But then that's also, I think, part of the reason why her other work is not as well received, because it doesn't fit into the milieu of what is being produced at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say about that. In terms of her fiction, a lot of the fiction that I read of her was on queer themes. And so I also think that is an added complexity.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. It's a lot for people to get into now.
Yeah.
We need people producing these things and publishing these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, I have never personally written a biography or done anything nearly as, you know, I mean, it's very all-encompassing. But I do find that just from preparing for this conversation and really like diving into Lorraine's life, I have learned a little bit about myself and like got very attached to like, and I feel like this happens, I feel like we talk about this all the time with all of our authors that we've covered, and when we talk to other authors about it, it's just very exciting to bring these writers back to life. And I'm curious, was there anything that you kind of learned about yourself or discovered? And it can be a kind of writing-based discovery, or even just like, you know, while you're going through these archives, like feelings that you had while working on this biography.
Well, I definitely felt my own hubris very early on in the process, because even though the Schomburg's Finding Aid is on its website and readily available for everyone, for some reason, I did not understand the magnitude of her body of work before I physically got there and realized, oh, there's 104 boxes.
That's so overwhelming.
And so I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to go write this book. It's going to be lickety split. She had a really short life. And then I'm like, wait, what? She wrote what? And so I was immediately confronted with my own hubris. And then I guess the other part, too, is that I had not realized she had been writing for Freedom and all the essays she had written before Raisin, in part because most of them are not available they're not digitized.
Okay.
So you would have to go get microfilm in order to read most of this writing. So I think that's another barrier to entry. But I think that was something that confronted me. And then I also realized, which actually was comforting when I was writing it, and this maybe seem odd, but I realized Hansberry probably wouldn't have liked me. So then that gave me space to sort of say what I wanted to say.
I can see that. Like, you're like, I would be friends with this person. I've had that feeling about authors, dead authors. It's easier when they're dead, then you don't have to like find out.
Right.
But
that's why we do.
Where you're like, no, I think we'd be friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get that. I love archival research. We were all talking about how much we love archives. You all should just go hang out at some archives sometimes. It's super cool.
Absolutely.
What was did you have kind of like a favorite discovery or a time when you felt particularly connected? I feel like that's something you can see, you know, you might see cigarette burns or mm-hmm. someone's, you know, handwriting or something like, or a smudge even on a page. And suddenly mm-hmm. you're like, I'm really reading this person's letters that they touched.
I know. There was definitely some of that. There were definitely folders that I opened that I was clear to me had not been opened since the papers were deposited at the Schomburg.
Wow.
Which made me feel kind of an ache in my heart.
Her spirit was just like, must have.
Yeah, it was, support your public libraries.
Yes.
But I would also say one of the things that was most touching to me is that in her personal writing, and by that I mean her journals, she wrote a lot about her fears and her insecurities. And it really, to me, made me feel like no matter how scared you are at certain times, that you can still be fierce and a brilliant writer and be scared. And so she was deathly afraid of hospitals, and she spent so much of the last part of her life in hospitals, which is heartbreaking. She was afraid of elevators, and when she would go to events, she would like march up the stairs and people would follow her and they thought she was just like this, like, you know, vivacious young person, but it was that she was scared to get on the elevator. I mean, she had all of these phobias, but you would never know it from her interviews or her public persona. So that was really endearing to me too.
In the loneliness you really capture, again, and like you said it perfectly. I mean, I think it's really useful to read as a writer, I think, where the self-doubt is real. And it's really great that, you know, you included those parts, because that's what makes anybody a person, those vulnerabilities.
Yeah, she writes, the thing that makes you great will also make you lonely.
I do also, I was just saying earlier, and that reminds me of this, that I only recently, because of your book, learned that she is the originator of the young, gifted, and black quote that I feel like has become like a hashtag and a t-shirt and all kinds of other things. So she also had this confidence, you know, we're talking about the lack of confidence, but that's a pretty, you know, that's a bold statement.
Yes, in her public appearances, she was incredibly bold. She was quietly resistant to people misunderstanding her. So she would correct people in a very charming and polite way, but she would constantly correct. And so you do, it does feel like you're dealing with a very different person when you read her journal entries and she talks about how much she's struggling versus the person you see in recordings, either visual or on sound.
I mean, that makes sense, right? We all do that to some extent, and I wonder if she felt a particular responsibility as a young, gifted, and black woman.
Yes, and as a first, like that pressure of being a first.
And you're never not going to be that, you know, once you're that, that's what you are.
Yeah.
Of her different roles, she found being a spokesperson the most uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can see that.
Wow. So I think we'll start to kind of wrap up and ask the question that we often ask before our lightning round, our wonderful writers who come on and join us in the show. Where would you say you see evidence of Lorraine's kind of impact, her energy today?
Oh my gosh, it's everywhere. Turn around, you bump into it. I think that, you know, I see it in the brilliant work of Lynn Nottage and Dominique Morisseau and all of the brilliant playwrights that we have now. Even if they're not writing in forms that Hansberry did, there's ways that she opened doors for, you know, our current generation of brilliant playwrights in their own right. I see it in, you know, the work of Audre Lorde and Black queer writing now as something that is much more visible, as it should be, than it was in her time. And so, you know, all of that is really exciting. And I also see it in the activist work and the idea of having a leaderful movement versus focusing on a spokesperson. And so that was part of what really made her uncomfortable with her fame and with the idea of being a spokesperson, because she believed that actual change happened through mass movements. And so focusing on individual people, she thought, was antithesis to what she thought would achieve the change that she wanted to see.
Yeah, we were talking about how the intersectionality that she possessed and was thinking with and answering questions with even before we had the term, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
She was very much ahead of her time.
She's so ahead of her time.
And actually, that brings us into our lightning round. We always do a lightning round at the end where we kind of try to imagine our dead writer in our current times. So it's just a little bit of fun.
We do a seance.
Exactly.
We won't do that today, though.
So our first question is, paperback, hardcover, audio, or ebook, which do you think would be her preferred method of reading?
I think her preferred method of reading would be audiobook, because she was often distracted, pulled in different directions. She could do it while she was doing something else. I think that she would like both, and she was also very much ahead of her time, so I think she would like newer technologies and the flexibility of that form.
That's great. If Lorraine Hansberry's life were to be dramatized and you, only you, no pressure, got to pick the medium, which would you choose? A feature film biopic, HBO miniseries, or maybe an in-depth podcast series, or fill in the blank on what you think would be best?
I think your podcast would be great, but I think Lorraine might pick an HBO miniseries because she could finally get her revenge for the drinking gourd.
Ah, yes.
I love it. What would Lorraine's pandemic project have been?
She would have been on the streets after George Floyd died.
Makes sense.
And organizing. She also wrote this essay, I'm not gonna be able to pull the name of it, but I tweeted about it during the pandemic, where she was talking about uneven access to healthcare. And so I think that she would have been enraged. I was like heartbroken, but I remember seeing this story at the very beginning of the pandemic, where it was talking about the dozens of Black people who had died in Chicago in the last week. And I think that she would have been enraged by what was happening in terms of the unequal access to healthcare and organizing. And so I think she would have been organizing around the pandemic, and she would have also been organizing in terms of the racial violence that happened during the pandemic.
Love that.
And our last question is, if there were to be another Raisin in the Sun remake, whether it's, or a restaging, doing it again, who would you like to see playing some of the leading roles or all of the leading roles?
Well, so I got a preview of this question when we were backstage, and I said I would want Issa Rae to play Benita. Issa, if you're listening, you should do it.
Yes.
But then I'm stuck on some of the other figures. I don't know. Okay, so hear me out on this. I think Jesse Williams could play Walter Lee only because he feels like the modern day Harry Belafonte to me.
That's so good.
I like it.
But I still don't know who would be Ruth and Mama. I don't
know.
I love to think about it.
Yeah. Actors' names. Like, it's funny, we give this question to people because I would be like, you're like, no name.
That one with the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. I love the Issa Rae idea, though. And we were talking about this before, and I can see her like producing. Mm-hmm. I can see she has the HBO relationship. So we could go back to have a whole HBO situation. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. We'll work it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Where can people find you online?
So at Dr. Soyica, Soyica on Twitter. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, I'm not on Instagram.
Okay, great. Well, everyone should check out her book, Radical Vision, about Lorraine Hansberry. You will learn even more than you learned here today. So thank you so much
for
being here. And thank you all for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.